outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Wayne, I have started a new hobby.
Oh no, as if you needed a new hobby. See, we already got hiking and backpacking in the woods and fly fishing and volleyball and woodworking. And so what have you added to that?
So this one actually kind of ties into the woodworking.
Okay.
So this fall, my wife was giving me a hard time because I love to cook. And an essential part of cooking is the knife that you use, and having a good knife. I'm sure you, as a meat chef, you know this.
Of course.
And so I'm always on the hunt for a good chef knife. Well, my wife was harassing me and she said, Kyle, you love making things. Why don't you just start building your own? And so I have. I got a little forge, and I have a lot of the other tools in my shop actually worked really well to switch over. And so I've started building knives, and it has been a phenomenal stress releaser, but B, I've started to give them away as gifts to our culinary staff here at the college. And I have a line now. Like I'm self-taught. I'm just starting, and I now have a line of people that are professional chefs here at the college that are all waiting for me to make them a new knife. And so it's been a really fun experience.
So I shouldn't be watching my mail to see if one's coming. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I'd love to build you one. You just got to tell me what style you want. And if you want it for meat cutting, what hardness of steel? It's been a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh. Yes, yes, yes to meat cutting, always.
Okay. The beauty of it is I've been trying to find something that I can do that's physical and that I can do when it's negative 12 outside. And so that
working in your forge. Limited.
Yes. So working in my shop on my forge with a heated garage is a huge plus.
Wow. Are these really cool looking like Viking knives that are look like they came from Game of Thrones or whatever?
Not quite that line. I do more of a minimalist style, but kind of my niche or specialty or whatever is I use old reclaimed lumber. So like old barn beams and stuff. And so every single handle is unique. Some of them have like old nail holes in them or pieces where the bugs have chewed through them and stuff. But because the wood is so hard, I use beech, which is a super dense, very, very hard wood. I can use a really fine grain sandpaper and it is like butter. You grab it and it is silky smooth, but.
Do you have one to show me or no?
I don't have one sitting here with me, but I will have to get you. I will send some that you can put on the pot or put up if you want to. I do have a few pictures that I've made, but yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And just to me anyway, it's been such a joy because one of my commitments for this year was I wanted to stop watching TV. I'd gotten into the rhythm or the habit of watching TV in the evenings and not really doing anything. And I just didn't like that. And so I decided, okay, what is something that I can do after Jess goes to bed, the girls are asleep, to where it's actually benefiting the world and benefiting me instead of me just going mind numb. This has been a great fit for that.
Yeah, can you put the God Journey on the handle?
I just looked at a custom brand that I can put on the handles for that exact reason, actually.
Oh, gosh. Branding knives. Special steel you got to use or just any kind of steel?
Oh, no. I use a special high carbon steel that's specifically designed for knife making.
Is this a knife that doesn't have to be sharpened? Because that's the worst part about owning a knife is you have to sharpen it all the time.
So I use 1095 steel, which is an extremely hard steel that will hold an edge for a very long time.
But some point, going to have to get your magic knife sharpening tools out and sharpen that monkey.
This is true, yes. But it will definitely hold an edge a lot better.
I found one that I really like, actually. It's where you just set the knife on a little magnetic thing at an angle, and then you roll this roller
thing. Yes.
We use that. And that's finally I found one that actually can get a sharp blade every time and don't have to monkey with it too much.
Well, and I'll even tell you the blade angle so that you can set your roller to the right angle to hone your blade the way you want it.
Okay. And for people who are listening who say I couldn't care less about knives, let's plunge in. I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. So best thing I heard this week, you got one.
I do. Yes. I was having a conversation with a student today, and it launched into a really beautiful, intriguing conversation about political psychology and religion, and even into some Native American traditions and history. And this student, that's their part of their background. And they introduced me to the idea of the trickster. Have you had any idea? Have you encountered this at all?
The trickster.
The trickster.
No.
It's a Native American folklore character, and often is associated with, like, gets associated with bad things or evil things or whatever. And yet the characteristics of the trickster are they're okay with imperfection. They laugh. They don't take life too serious. They poke fun at the system, and they do not give in to pressure of authority. They challenge social norms. They provoke thought. They're playful, humorous, and they frustrate the serious.
Are these real people? This is not like a leprechaun and a Irish kind of mythological thing. Is it that, or is it actually people that are tricksters?
No, it's a mythological character.
Okay.
And often assigned to, you know, in these different stories, they're teaching us morals about human interaction or life, that type of thing. But it was really interesting because what really resounded with me is it was talking about how asking questions and being playful is often assigned as an evil trait. And yet for me, as I was thinking about it, I was like, I'm fairly certain that the God that I know is a loving trickster. Like, if you go off of those characteristics, like, he is playful, he challenges and pokes holes in my norms and my understanding. He challenges the authorities that wear his name and yet maybe not necessarily align with his character and his heart. And yet he's playful. He doesn't take it too serious. Like, it was just this beautiful encounter with a student as we were having a conversation today about, I think God might be a loving trickster sometimes. He's got a great sense of humor. He can be kind of a little ornery every once in a while. Like, all, like, I was like, wait a minute. That sounds very familiar to the God that I encounter on a fairly regular basis.
Jehovah sneaky, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree that he's incredibly playful. And I agree we sometimes are too serious to somehow miss what he's up to in our lives. Yeah.
And yeah, the assignment of playful joy, laughter as being potentially evil or being bad. And that, like, man, that resonated a tone with me, because for me, some of the personal work that I'm doing right now is around this space where I remember in third grade when I realized that it was not safe to be playful and carefree, that I needed to be serious and disciplined. And I remember exactly where I was at, the setting that I was in, and it has not shifted. I've been trying, as God's been healing my heart, he's been bringing that back, and I've been catching snapshots and getting to enjoy that part of me again to a degree. But gosh, it was assigned as weakness. It was assigned as stupidity. It was assigned as evil or bad
or frivolous.
Yeah. Yes. And yet I'm finding more and more as I get to know Father that's his delight. Like, that's part of his character and that's part of who he made me to be. And to have just said, no, that's a terrible part of who God created me to be. I'm going to get rid of that piece. It has been an interesting untangling to see God breathing life back into those dead bones.
Yeah, over the last couple of years, as we've talked about love, rest, and play, the one pushback I get most often is on play.
Yeah.
I remember growing up in the religious environment which I grew up in, play and God would never show up in the same reality. In fact, anything lighthearted in the presence of God or God places where God's supposed to be, like a sanctuary, was regarded as sacrilegious.
Yes, disrespect, evil, like complete disregard of the value of God.
Right. I remember that whole formulating that sense of fear about God and the sense of awe and in the sense of be careful, you got to look over your shoulder at every moment. The idea that God being playful, us being playful with God, that's the pushback I get the most is from people who can't imagine that play is one of those things. And part of it's love and rest. You can find lots of scriptures for both of those in our relationship with God. And there's nothing in the Bible about play, except I think it's all that childlikeness that it talks about that opens the door to us being engaged with God. And without a child's heart, it's difficult to see him because there is moments, I know even through the cancer and even through things I've dealt with in my life recently have been painful. There's always a playfulness to God engaging me at points of pain. But to regard it as evil or to shunt it off to the side. And I remember that intentionally being done in the religious environments I grew up in. You could play out there somewhere, but you couldn't play in here. You couldn't run in the sanctuary. You couldn't laugh.
Yes.
Yes. And even back in the day, I don't think pastors were as much jokesters as most pastors try and start with a joke today or something, try and be funny. That wasn't even a part of it back then. Everything was so incredibly intense and serious. And anything off that mark, which I think, particularly if it's true in Native American culture too, a lot of us just because you're challenging the status quo conformity norms. Yeah. And that cannot be permitted in anything that is finding its security in our norms, in how we've outlined things to be. And humor and playfulness just is not allowed in that kind of environment because it leads toward nonconformity.
Again, it's mind-blowing to me because it's like, I remember reading Brené Brown's first feedbacks when she was discovering play in her own research, even though play therapy had been, and the research on play had been going on for a long time. Her feedback from her research was, you know, I'm observing wholehearted people and they seem to mess around a lot. Like they seem to just like screw around without any purpose. And one of her colleagues was like, Brené, that's called play. Doing something for the fun of it without any point. That is called play. And it was like earth shattering to her.
Oh my gosh.
Because that to do something, and she talks about, especially in The Gift of Imperfection, she talks about how disorienting it was to set aside the intense, the researcher, the drivenness, the seriousness of the person, and being able to just relax into doing something for the fun of it and being seen as goofy, being seen as imperfect, being seen as ridiculous and finding joy in that.
Yep. Well, I guess I'm a trickster too. Got in trouble in the back in the day, but and I get in trouble today now and then.
I'd say you still embody some of those trickster elements.
I probably do. Think I'd grow out of it one of these days.
Yeah, no way. So best thing you heard this week.
You know, it comes from scripture, actually. Sarah and I, for the first time since I was diagnosed and operated on or whatever, Sarah and I took a 2-day trip away. Just, I had to get out of the cabin, get a little cabin fever. So it'd be nice to get out. And so we went up to a little town called Solvang, which is a Danish village near here. Everything's done up Danish-like. And we've had a lot of people tell, we've driven by it forever and never actually stopped in. So we stopped in this time and we had a day and the last morning we were there, we're just reading scripture, reading John 20. And the disciples after the resurrection have gone back to Galilee and doing a little fishing. And well, they're trying to do fishing. They're not catching anything, but they come in after an all night attempt to fish and got nothing. And they see Jesus on the beach, but they don't know it's Jesus. They have no idea. And he says, hey, throw that net on the other side of the boat and see what you get. And threw the net over there, and they got this huge 153 fish, large fish, packed out the net, almost ripped it. And John leans over to Peter and says, it is the Lord. And Peter jumps in the water and swims over to be with Jesus. And I tell you, when I was reading that to Sarah and I got to that, it is the Lord, I was just completely, I couldn't keep reading. I had lost my ability to read. I was so moved by that moment because to me, that's the moment in any circumstance where everything changes. When you realize where the Lord is in it, what he's doing. It is the Lord. I know for Sarah's trauma memory that she had a couple years ago of being in this bathroom with this horrible thing going on. There's this light ray coming through, and she's relating this to me in real time while she's having the memory. She's actually talking me through it. And all of a sudden she has this light coming through the window. It's so bright. It's Jesus, she said. And my first thought is, it's Jesus. Oh my gosh, why isn't he stopping this? You know, is she going to go into that vein of thinking? And she didn't. It's just like, he's here. I'm safe now. Even though horrible things are still going on to her in the memory, it was shaped by the fact that Jesus had made an appearance there and she could lay her head in his lap and be at peace. And I think that that came to mind, just everything with the cancer diagnosis, the chemotherapy. When Jesus makes himself known, when you realize it is the Lord, and we go through a lot of our circumstances, not necessarily recognizing where he is. And then when it suddenly becomes clear, and I think about that with the disciples, if Jesus is resurrected from the dead, you would think he'd spend every day with the disciples. I would think, but he shows up on Sunday. Maybe that's how we got Sunday services. I don't know. Jesus only shows up on Sunday anyway. So why? But it's the first day of the week that he meets them at the resurrection. He meets them the following week in the upper room. And then he meets them on the shore of Galilee while they're fishing. And it really is when we're going through stuff, it's the moment when Jesus lets himself be seen or we're aware of him. And it's not like we may not recognize him before. It's not that he's not there before. He's there without the disciples realizing who it is. But then he does something that catches their attention. Mm-hmm. And boy, we're looking for that in our lives in so many ways. And it's been true inside this cancer. I've seen the Lord inside there. I know it's him. I know he's with me through this. We're seeing that with Sarah's trauma memories, some which she's still having. And it's lovely when God makes himself known, then the circumstance has the power to change.
I love that. I was reading an author a while ago, and they used the illustration of, they felt like trying to follow God was like driving into the sun with a mud splattered windshield. Like I can barely see the road. Like, and I'm not even sure if I'm still on the road, but then every once in a while, the windshield wipers will go and the water sprays on the window and cleans it a little bit. And there's these moments of clarity or encounter or experience where, oh, it is the Lord. There he is. That, mm-hmm. oh, there he's right here. Like he's right in there. He is. And I really resonated with that illustration because it does a lot of the time feel like I'm driving a car through life and I turn into the wind or turn into the sun and there's mud all over my windshield and I'm just praying that I can stay between the lines on the road. And yet, those moments of clarity where I get the snapshots, and sometimes in a very playful way or a very unexpected way, he's like, oh yeah, I'm right here. Or yes, I'm following you in this, or I'm leading you in this. Or I mean, yeah, it's those beautiful moments.
And what I like about it is that sometimes we don't always see that. Yeah. So it's okay that there are times when we've lost sight of where he is, but then he will come and make himself known. And maybe after days or weeks of praying about, oh God, would you make yourself known to me here or whatever. But that's really in his control, not ours. We can provide an open heart and a ready place, but we can't make him show up in a way we want him to. And it's just better to relax into that place of when he wants me to see him, he will make himself known. And when he does, now my heart comes to rest. Now my heart comes to peace. And now I know a bit more how to navigate this situation that I'm involved in. I mean, it fully undid me. I've read that verse hundreds of times in my life. And just sitting there with Sarah that morning just undid me in a way that says that's what we need more than anything is, where is the Lord? When does he show up? What does he offer us? And he seems to somehow kind of enjoy that because he shows up on the beach and they don't recognize him. The road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until he broke bread with them. So he seems to, some of that drawing toward him without clarity is part of the process of maybe him becoming more clear. And so I think there's a process in there that we somehow want to take control of ourselves. Like, I'm going to spend an hour here praying to Jesus, and by the end of that, I don't know exactly what I need to know. And you don't have to walk with him very long to realize that doesn't work unless you're making up your answers yourself.
Correct.
When he appears, when he makes himself known, it's wonderfully real and wonderfully obvious, and it allows us to have. But the danger is we kind of make up that he's there when he's not there. Not that he isn't always there, because he is, yeah. But make up the answer we think we need or the thought to somehow set our hearts at rest when it's not yet him.
Yes. When the windshield wipers haven't actually cleaned the windshield, we're just saying, okay, well, I'm going to turn the steering wheel to the right, and it's God. He's there. He's with us.
And I'm going to hit a tree. Yeah,
exactly.
Smack.
Exactly. I think, though, one of the things that I love about that passage is that to me anyway, it just seems like so unspiritual, and yet it's so playful and it's so relational, because it harkens back to how he met them, right? Like, cast your nets on the other side. It is not, he's not meeting them at the synagogue. He's not meeting them at their house. They're out fishing and he's meeting them on the beach. And then, you know, Peter's like, it's the Lord. And just, into the water, he's like, my best friend is on the beach. Like, I am going this, like, here we go. And
he's already cooking fish for him. He doesn't even need their fish. He's already got some in mind.
He's already making breakfast.
He's already got it going.
Like, to me, especially as an outdoorsman, it's like, I would be thrilled if when I get to heaven, Jesus is waiting for me beside an alpine lake cooking me fish and is like, hey, come on over, good friend. Like, I'm excited to see you. Like, I can't wait. That's awesome.
Well, the next time you're waist deep in one of those cold alpine creeks and you're fishing and you see a figure on the beach saying, hey, Kyle, try over there, and you catch something, you might go check that out a little more.
Yeah, I'm going to throw my rod down.
Well, yeah, come running to the beach and go, what's happening, dude? What's up? What a moment for the boys. What a moment.
Yeah.
A couple of emails here. Might want to read here. This is from Mike. This often writes to us, and I like this. You start the 117 podcast with C.S. Lewis quotes that make me cry with all the implications, and follow up with a discussion of what honest love looks like. That was what we did on community. And I cannot think of a better discussion to listen to. If I tried to explain the implications of what I felt I heard in what you discussed, it would take me forever to explain its impact and reassurance. The two themes that kept repeating in my mind are how much people are marked by humility when they are confronted, connected with love. And because love is unlike us, it never, never ceases to surprise us in the most beautiful ways, people and places. It's so beautiful that we know it from outside of ourselves, that we know love. I love that. And this from a woman in Norway says, we are sorry to hear about your journey with pain and that you have cancer. We have listened to your reflections about both living with pain and prayers for healing, and your last podcast where you are so open about the embarrassment about getting cancer. All the things you are learning in this difficult time, it is both beautiful and heartbreaking to listen to. I love your honesty, and it brings healing to my heart. I believe it will help healing to others, too, who have felt shame about being sick and are in such need of help. And then she tells her own story. I've got something called complex regional pain syndrome. Heard of it?
No,
I had not either. After an operation in my foot that I had in October 2023, in practice, this means extreme nerve pain 24/7. 3 months into this pain nightmare, I had run out. Out of strength, out of hope, I was eventually unable to pray, read the Bible, or turn to God, and I felt ashamed about this. I had this way of thinking that I had to do this to get God's strength to deal with it. During all this time, I had nevertheless felt Jesus was sitting by my side. I just didn't have the energy to reach out to him, even just to say help. Then on the 2nd of January, 2024, he sat by my side as usual. Maybe I noticed him more clearly that day. It is the Lord. She said, I don't know. I remember being able to lift my head to look at him, and for the first time since October, and I said simply, I'm sinking. Then I heard him say, it's okay, because I'm holding you with my prayers. I received his grace in this moment. His help, his beautiful, wonderful help. The words Jesus says to Paul in 2 Corinthians 12, and she wrote this before we did the podcast about 2 Corinthians 12, was mine in this moment. My grace is enough. It's all you need. My strength comes into its own in your weakness. I don't know if I'll ever be able to walk again. I love to go to the mountains and play with the grandkids. Thank you for all you're sharing with us in your podcast. You make footprints of Jesus in our hearts. Good tagline for the God Journey. You make footprints of Jesus in our hearts, or making footprints of Jesus. That's a lovely email. Appreciate that, all the way from Norway.
That's a beautiful. Oh, I love that email.
It's the same thing. It is the Lord. When God shows up, he's there. But somehow that morning, she connects with presence in a way that, even though it still leaves her disappointed at what she can't do, she's at rest inside God's love and care in spite of it.
It's interesting. I'm thinking about that and those moments of clarity, and how when God collides with our lives or breaks into our lives, reveals himself in those moments, how powerful that can be. And I mean, for me, my own story and how transformational that was for me personally. And today in our counseling skills class, we got into a conversation about, we were talking about who you are in the chair. So who are you going to be as a therapist, and knowing yourself and your life history and, you know, some of those triggers. But we then got into a conversation about what client would be a hot button for you. Like, what client would be a button that you would not want, like somebody you would not want to have sit in the chair across from you. And almost resoundingly in the class, it was, I would not be able to deal with somebody who was lying to me, manipulating me, that was lying to themselves. And it launched us into this deep conversation about how often do we lie to ourselves who are navigating this, like, this different world. And then God's truth lands in our lap, that opportunity to see the truth, to align with life, and how resistant people are to that. And we talk, so here are these budding counseling students that are going to be working with people in a variety of different capacities. And we're talking about, why is it so difficult to allow truth into our lives? Why is it so difficult for us to not want, in my mind, as they were talking about, to not want kingdom to begin to break through those strongholds or those spaces in our life. It was a cool conversation that we got into. When I think about who God's created us to be, our capacity when we're navigating these things, and it's so vital to encounter his love. It's so vital that to have those tangible experiences, those relational experiences with Father's heart, where it's like, no, this is undeniable. Like, he stepped in such a way that he revealed himself in a way to me that showed his perspective or his life or his light into something that I never would have been able to get clarity on before, or never thought could be healed, or never thought could be restored. Or he's so good at that. And yet, how often do we resist it? How often are we willing to lie, to manipulate, to stonewall, to protect? Like that C.S. Lewis quote that I mentioned the other day, how good are we at distracting ourselves or pushing away the truth, the good that God wants to bring into our lives?
And isn't that would be part of what the kingdom of darkness is all about?
Yeah.
Because most of us who like to believe a lie don't know we're believing a lie.
Yes.
We formatted our lives around some dishonest, deceptive reality, but we somehow have taken comfort inside that reality. And in taking comfort in it, then it's when truth comes, we're not ready for it, or we're, again, push it away because it's going to disturb the equilibrium I have found in the lie I have when I didn't know it was a lie, when it was just a comforting thing, an opinion that grounded me in some kind of comfortable place. And then when truth comes, that's why truth is so disturbing. And I think anybody who's going to practice therapy or be involved in helping other people in their journey realize, man, there comes the moment at which truth has to break into this, but it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy for the person to see it. It's not going to be easy for them to acknowledge it. In fact, it may come right at them in a way that just hurts deeply, and they push it aside, and it may take 3, 4, 5 weeks before that truth finally finds a home in the heart that's so resistant. And I think that's how the enemy has set up this world of darkness, is it? And the salvation is to be transferred from the kingdom of darkness into this kingdom of light, which sounds glorious when you read it in Ephesians 1 or Colossians 1. It sounds glorious.
Yes.
But the fact is, when God's moving us from something we believe to be true that isn't, to the thing that is true and discomforting, it's always a challenge. And it's easy for us to retreat back into our lies.
Well, we were talking, I love that you talk about comfort. We were actually talking about, are they in class today, are they comfortable or is it just familiar? Right? Because there's this, well, I've created this lie. I've created this perception, this translation of how I experience this thing, because that's protecting me, shielding me, distancing myself from the truth. And yet, like, I don't think it's actually comfortable, especially like the more that I've encountered God's truth, the more that I've encountered his love and kingdom breaking through those things, I find that, no, I'm actually living in my own, in some regards, self-concocted version of hell or a piece of hell.
Yeah.
And, but it's familiar. And so I would rather have the familiarity in those places at times than the very unnerving, I don't have any control over this truth and love and life of Father breaking in and bringing his light into those spaces.
Especially since truth is going to move me. And if I don't want to be moved, whether it's familiarity or comfort, if I don't want to be moved, then it's easy to put aside the light as more untruth, because it's not the truth I want. And that's partly what disturbs me about the language you're using, about talking about my truth. I'm talking about my truth. Or what if your truth is a lie?
Yes.
And so many times it is, because we find comfort in something or familiarity in something that actually is keeping us from life.
Yes.
But we don't see that. If we saw it, we would chuck it and run for life. But life is very costly. Scripture keeps coming back to that. I've, in the last couple of weeks, I've had an opportunity to have some conversations with people who were important in my life 30 years ago when they lied about a resignation I had not offered. And just being now inside some beautiful conversations that may lead to reconciliation. One of the things that I keep coming to in that conversation, because I'm talking to two different people at the same time, and they're not in the same conversation. So I'm seeing what it is that people began to believe and how they came to believe it, and how they, when you finally go, well, don't hold it a minute, because that wasn't true. Do you remember this? And they'll go, oh my gosh, I forgot about that. You're right, that wasn't true. But what they thought was true had influenced their decisions 30 years ago, had influenced conclusions they'd make in the 30 years since. And now coming to a place of maybe seeing that that may not have been grounded in something that was true, and have opened to it, not been resistant, not fought it off, not fought it, whatever. But what I've been aware of, I guess, is the power of gossip and why gossip is such one of those things that Proverbs warns us about, and Paul puts it in all his lists of major sins. He warns us about malicious gossip, or just the gossip that, because here's what it does. Gossip takes my suspicion, and when I find somebody else who has the same suspicion, it turns it into a fact for all practical purposes. Yeah. And no one's ever consulted the person about which we've reached a conclusion. Mm-hmm. To see if that conclusion has any basis in truth. And when you even where gossip has reigned for so long and people have reinforced their own misperception into an avenue of truth, then when the person who's actually the object of the gossip comes forward and says, hold it, that's not true. The answer is not, well, we should consider that. The response is often, liar. You're a liar, because we've already got the truth. We've confirmed it with each other. And that's the power of gossip, which is why Paul warned us, don't do that. Don't have conversations about people in a negative way when that person is not there contributing to the conversation, because it will cement preconceptions in your mind that will, and this is what Proverbs says, will destroy relationships. And that's how the enemy just, that's that bad kind of negative trickster thing that the enemy often is, which is, I'm going to set a lie in here to separate good brothers from each other. And we're discovering that that's what happened 30 years ago.
And that's, I mean, good brothers, good community, good marriages, good families, right?
Yes,
I mean,
all that.
All of it. And it takes so many different phases. So again, conversations with students about the idea of counseling and counseling process, we got into a dialogue because I have had multiple conversations where a therapist was in a working relationship with a client and they did a remote diagnosis based solely off of the information that was being provided by their client. And we were talking about this in my ethics, especially growing or going through my training at Azusa Pacific. That was one of the big ethical conversations, is how to guard against giving a remote diagnosis solely based off of the perception of your client. Now, obviously, if they come in and they're covered in bruises and they have broken bones and they say, yes, my spouse did X or my partner did whatever, then yes, you have to take steps to be able to make sure that they're safe. But I can't tell you how many people I have talked to over the years that got painted in a completely different light, and they received a remote diagnosis from a therapist that they never talked to, that they never encountered, that they never experienced before. And so then the therapist is providing counseling and providing support and providing resources based off of this remote diagnosis that has never even been discussed or encountered with that person face to face. They have no context other than what their client is telling them. It can be so destructive.
Well, that's what happened with Sarah and I. I mean, the therapist was able to destroy our marriage, concluding I must be an abusive husband or Sarah wouldn't have this PTSD, without ever having a conversation with me. And that was so frustrating to realize someone could actually destroy our marriage on a basis of an assumption that she never took the time to find out if that assumption had any validity.
Correct.
Now, thankfully, Sarah was able to move beyond that and be able to see that, hey, maybe this wasn't true, and God was able to pull that all back together. But I think that happens hundreds of times a day in working relationships, in other kinds of relationships, where people just get talking about something. That whole idea of where gossip is where suspicions go to become fact, even if they're not fact.
Yes.
And how much life can be destroyed. Because seeing the environment of where gossip got into, not just my relationship with Sarah, it got into my relationship with these other people with whom I was in ministry with. And no one sat down with me to say, Wayne, is this what you're thinking? They concluded this was my thought. My own family did that in relationship to my dad. The same thing. Gossip carries tremendous power, because if you find someone to agree with your fear becomes a fact, whether or not it's true. And then you discount that whole confirmation bias thing. You discount anything that argues against what you have already come to believe, to the point of even, I've had this said to me, you're lying. When I said, look, this isn't true, you're a liar. And once you pull that card, the relationship is over. There's no way to resurrect the friendship as long as the person who's being gossiped about can no longer be believed.
Yeah,
because we've cemented these things in our heart. And that's one of the things I saw in the first church I worked at a long time ago, how much people would come to me about negative things about some of the other people in leadership, because they're looking for somebody to kind of, and I would always turn to them and say, hold on a minute. They'd say, can I share with something about Tim? And I'd say, what? Yeah, I want to share with something. Excuse me a minute. I'd go, hey, Tim, what are you doing? I said, we're going to talk about Tim. We ought to have Tim here, right? Yeah. Like, no. Well, then don't talk to me. And I have practiced that in family. I've practiced it in ministry. Oh my, don't share with me something about somebody else that you're angry about and upset about if you're not willing to talk about it with them. And I don't get to get input from them, because they're obviously, most of those times, you're going to swear you to secrecy, which I don't ever let anybody do. I'm going to say, listen, confidentiality, you have it as long as it affects you. But if you're coming in my life to erode my confidence in a relationship I have, I need to talk to the other person to find out if these things are true. And that's somehow we've just neglected that in the body of Christ. That's why Paul keeps talking about gossip's just one of those things that you don't want to be a part of. It's right up there with all the other drunkenness and all the other bad things, immorality. Gossip is right there. Because gossip does incredible damage when people can't step back and go, okay, is what we're talking about even true? It feeds my fear. It feeds your fear. So it must be true. Instead of maybe we're both afraid of a boogeyman that doesn't exist. And rather than creating the boogeyman, maybe we'd talk to the boogeyman and find out, oh, that's not what you're thinking. No, it's not. It never has been. I wouldn't even aim that direction. And yet people can use each other to embellish the lie that already exists within them. And that's what gossip does at its worst.
It does. And I think one of the reasons why it is so deadly is it's also so subtle and so seductive, right? Like to say, oh, well, you know, gossip's on par with sexual immorality. You know, in general, our evangelical Christian world would be like, no, like me going and sleeping with a prostitute is on the same par as me having gossiping about my friends or my family. Or, and yet, is it just as relationally destructive? Yeah, it's introducing a level of toxicity that can really erode the foundations and the trust and the connection between you and another person. And yet, even for myself, it's hard. To know, okay, when am I processing about a genuine concern about a person that I want to make sure that they're doing okay versus how am I just getting sucked into the drama, the gossip, the I'm just talking about this person without any health or hope or holding them in high regard. And it's so subtle.
And what of us doesn't get slid into that kind of wanting to hear the gossip thing that's, you know, negatively slanting against someone, because then I'll feel better about myself if I'm hearing something negative about someone else. And it's an addiction all its own. And once you get into a circle of gossip, a cycle of gossip, it will destroy the relationships around you, except the people that hold the same fears you do. And believe me, that's not a community you want to be a part of when you're believing the lies together and destroying other relationships. But we have this sense of, well, Bob, we really know the truth and we've got it all sorted out in our minds. And the fact is you don't. And when you go down that road, you hurt people who don't deserve to be hurt by the gossip that you're spreading.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.